Hi, I'm Russell and I work at The Video Store, the place that you can go to once a week when you're looking for something to watch. When the store is quiet, behind the counter, I get to talk to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see the thing yesterday on the TV?
Yells it.
Hello.
Good morning.
How you guys doing?
I'm good, dude. How are you?
Yeah. I'm lekker, man.
Nice.
How's this rain?
Yeah. I love it.
We needed it.
Yeah.
I was looking at Russell like, say the thing, say the thing.
No, it's the most bully thing to say. But when you get older, and if you ever have to look after a patch of lawn.
Dude, yes. I'm in that stage where I'm like, oh, thank God for the rain.
When I had a garden,
yes.
I took such great joy in, even in the rain, I would run over to the sprinkler control thing to turn it off because I took such great joy knowing I didn't have to waste
exactly,
water.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm at that stage as well. Like, so we laid down a new lawn last year. Last year. But like, actually beginning of the year before the real big rains came.
Yeah.
Right.
And lay down new lawn. I was like, oh shit, you know, because when you lay down new lawn, you have to like water it every day for like a week and a bit.
Yeah.
And like, oh, the rain came and I was like, thank God, this is amazing.
It's lovely. And you getting older and maturing, as you realize, if you live in South Africa, specifically Joburg, you realize like it's very arid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, we don't get a lot of rain. Mm. So when we do, bless them.
Right.
Old Toto, bless these rains. Welcome to The Video Store. Thank you for wandering in. We've got ourselves a Graham G-Force Hackney.
Hello.
Who is an editor and the producer, the award-winning producer of this show. And we got ourselves a Perrin P-Dog Fish.
Hello.
Fish.
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 Yeah.
I've never kind of really said it out loud.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lovely name. I like your name, Perrin. I think it's a very cool name.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
And a master of watching lots and lots of movies.
But you're going to say master of none.
No. No, you have watched more movies than everyone listening combined.
Yeah.
We treasure you immensely. My name is Russell. I'm the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And today it's just us behind the counter having ourselves a fat chat.
Nice. Lekker.
I am the most excited to talk about one battle after another.
Oh, yeah.
The new PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, is now in cinemas around the world. And everyone is realizing how fucking good it is.
Yes.
Yeah, it's so good.
I had to keep it to myself for a few weeks after having seen it as a exhibitor.
Cool.
And I desperately wanted to talk to other people about it.
Mm.
And I desperately wanted to tell everyone how cool it is.
So jealous. Oh my God. So jealous. Jeez.
But Perrin, it's now after the weekend and you've already seen it?
Twice, yeah.
That's amazing. This is why you were on the show.
Yeah.
Because it's a love.
Yeah.
And your passion and your love for cinema, I think, is the best part.
Thank you.
What's the most you've ever watched a movie on one weekend?
Ooh, I think, like, so Paul Thomas Anderson, so he's one of my top three filmmakers ever. So whenever his movies are in the cinema, I, like, go as often as I can.
Right.
I think the most I've seen in a weekend, I think it might have been The Master, actually. I watched it three times on the weekend.
Every day?
Yeah.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Went to the first screening on a Friday at Nouveau. I had the whole cinema to myself. That was amazing. And then, I went on the Saturday and the Sunday. And
no, that's amazing. What I think we should do is we're going to talk about one battle after another, but there's more to talk about around it.
Yeah. 100%.
So just remember, because I interacted with someone at our video store Presents Night, and they said they'd listen, but they were afraid that we were going to give spoilers.
Okay.
And I thought, I wonder whether a lot of people have been deterred by our podcast at the risk of hearing spoilers.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important to mention, We are very good about that.
Yeah, we try to be at least.
And
yeah,
we
try not to talk about the movie itself specifically. We talk around it and what makes it interesting and what makes it themes, good and what you can enjoy around it. So I think there's a lot to talk about with that, as well as Paul Thomas Anderson's filmography, of which, I'll be honest, I've only done one or two.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for some reason, I was trying to think about it, like why I missed quite a few of them, and I think it's just the crazy busyness of life.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I, all those years in the band, I didn't watch as much movies as I should have.
Right.
Because we were dicking around. And also over on Apple TV Plus, we watched an interesting movie, All of You.
Yeah, okay. I saw your post on the group. Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit there.
Cool.
All right. Cool. Let's get into it with a little round of Hey, Did You Guys See?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Who wants to kick it off?
You want to go?
Yeah, you go. Let me buy me some time.
Okay. Okay, speaking of one battle after another, Hey, Did You Guys See? Leonardo DiCaprio has now opened films at number one in the box office in as many as four different decades.
Oh, that's crazy. Luck.
Making him arguably the sure of movies. No, she very famously has had a number one in like five decades.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah, sure is quite special. And with the whole, do you believe? Love?
Well, I was thinking movies. I'm like, I'm only thinking of Moonlight. And
No. Yeah. No, what Cher did for music is what Leo is doing for the film industry.
Mm.
So yeah, I think that's just lovely. I think it's cool that we had it open at number one, which is cool. And a big shout out to old Leo.
Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, I'm also very happy for Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes.
Because like, even though it's, we'll talk about that later, but that's crazy with DiCaprio, because that's a movie... Because DiCaprio is one of those actors now where he can pick and choose his projects.
Oh, yeah.
And also, he only does like one movie a year now.
Mm.
And I often find when actors get into a specific caliber, they only do one movie a year. Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis was one. Joaquin Phoenix is now that.
Yeah.
And they're all in, which is great.
Yeah.
Is that you've got a character who's rolling around literally in the sort of basements and rooftops in a gown and a sort of sweaty outfit.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so beneath the Hollywood star
where,
you know he really got into it.
Yeah.
And he became this kind of lowlife stoner, you know, Big Lebowski.
Yes-esque.
You know, where someone like Tom Cruise gets to be Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He gets to be this like sophisticated, highly capable
action star,
you know, operating at the optimum level. He gets to be that.
Yes.
Where it's interesting when you got a big Hollywood star that sort of goes down.
Yeah, Leo has very deliberately shunned the pretty boy image for quite a while now.
Yeah, he has.
I think post-Titanic, he's really just...
He rarely does interviews as well. Yes. So like when he's doing a press junkets for this, you know that he really believes in the project. Mm. Like it's crazy. Like the only times he'll ever do it would be Scorsese and like Tarantino. Like basically all the directors he picks and chooses, because he's got a bucket list.
Yeah.
And PTA had been on his bucket list since Boogie Nights, because famously he chose not to be in Boogie Nights. He got the role.
Mark Wahlberg's role.
Yeah, he chose to do Titanic instead.
Okay.
And that would have affected the trajectory of his career, I reckon. But it's interesting, though, because DiCaprio, when they were about to shoot that, because he told PTA, like, quite close to shoot, like, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to do this. And he actually worked on Basketball Diaries with Mark Wahlberg. And he was like, hey, you should work with Mark Wahlberg. Okay. I think he's perfect for the role.
Cool.
And he ended up being perfect for the role. I mean, famously, Burt Reynolds and Mark Wahlberg hate Boogie Nights because they feel like it goes against their moral compass, what it's about, even though it's the best film both of them ever did. It's still Mark Wahlberg's best role, even though he got his Oscar nomination for The Departed.
Yeah.
But I think it's his best role. He's so funny in it.
Yeah, Boogie Nights is great.
Mark Wahlberg has a moral compass.
Yeah. Well, he's just in like Angel Studio movies now.
I think he's starring in movies
with Mel Gibson.
The guy who went to jail for trying to beat a Vietnamese man to death.
Yeah, exactly. So, hey, he's Boston.
Sure. From Southie.
He found God and he found a stray dog.
Is that Mel Gibson?
No, Mark Wahlberg and that Andre the Hero or some shit.
Oh, yeah.
That dog movie.
The Dog in the Jungle movie.
The Dog in the Jungle. Oh. Speaking of Paul Thomas Anderson and hiring people, there's a great clip of John C. Reilly saying, you know, he was always in Paul Thomas Anderson's films. One day he was like, listen, you don't feel like you have to hire me. And then he's never been hired since.
the only time he's been in one was Licorice Pizza. He was in the, what's the name of that Monster Family sitcom from like the 60s or 50s? The Munsters.
Munsters, yeah.
Yeah, there's a scene where they're at like a convention and he's playing like the dad. And you just see him in passing. Okay. And like, I've watched that clip as well. And he's we're still really good friends, but like...
I'm not in his movies anymore.
He's like, clearly I'm not right for the parts anymore, you know?
Cool. Who's next?
Hey, did you guys see that Disney rushed out a trailer for The Mandalorian and Groglet in order to distract from all their bad press?
Oh, I forgot the trailer dropped. I didn't watch it.
Yeah.
It seemed like a rush trailer.
Oh, yeah. There's no dialogue in the whole trailer. Oof. There's not a line of dialogue.
It's just a teaser.
It's just like clips of footage that make no sense together.
Oof.
They just took shots and like blip, 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 blip.
I love dialogue-less trailers, but when they make sense. Like,
yes.
Christopher Nolan teasers are the best trailers you can watch because they are like captivating. They're well put together. There's a narrative flow to it.
Mm.
But like, I remember the Dead Reckoning trailer when that came out. It was also just a series of things.
Right.
And they released that trailer when they were still shooting as well because they wanted to build hype because the Fallout was so freaking incredible. Yes. That's interesting.
But
when is the movie coming?
Yeah, let's just unpack this. So this is a movie.
Yes, The Mandalorian and Grogu. Terrible name. Terrible name.
Yeah, it's not invented.
Awful name. But it's a continuation of the series, The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
They're not doing a fourth season. They're doing a movie.
Is that going to wrap it up?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure they've said they're not doing a fourth season, and this is kind of the continuation from the TV show.
Logically, I feel like that would be the final.
Yeah.
Why are you... I mean, I could see how the name's not very inventive, but why do you think it's so terrible?
It just sounds awful to just like say it, The Mandalorian and Grogu.
Yeah.
It just sounds
awful.
It
doesn't roll
off
the tongue.
And it's also like nothing. It tells you nothing about the movie other than The Mandalorian is a character everyone like knows at this point, and Grogu, who is a marketing device.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it just feels like a cash grab.
Yes.
I've seen a great thing, and I don't want to unopen... I don't want to open a can of Star Wars worms here, but
they're called Zlops, actually.
Just because I know how far you could take it, but I saw something once which was like how inappropriately named all the Star Wars movies are, and how like if you actually swap some of the names around, it makes far more sense.
Okay. Yeah, like the Clone Wars doesn't make sense because you don't see any of it. Like, it should
actually be the name of the whatever,
and this
should be the name of the whatever. And it's like you can actually swap. They're somewhat interchangeable.
It's actually interesting. Yeah, I remember New Hope was changed to like earlier in the series or something. Like, it's very interesting.
It just
depends
on what you want to put the
the
focus on the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah.
Where's that from again?
I don't know.
I know that's from a movie,
I don't know whether it's a movie reference.
Or that's just a thing,
It's just a thing people say. have you got one, P-Dog?
Yeah.
No Presh?
So Terrence Stamp, I didn't know this was happening. So Terrence Stamp, obviously he passed away recently.
Yeah.
He finished shooting his scenes for the Priscilla, Queen of the Desert sequel.
Oh, is that
before they wrapped? And there's a sequel coming from the same director.
Huh.
Interesting.
So that's interesting because I love the original film. So I'm interested to see where they are now. Like, why do we need to go back?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're legacy sequels, eh? Fucking hell.
They're tough.
Yeah, they are tough because, I mean, I'm trying to think of legacy sequels that actually worked.
Yeah, no, I agree. For the most part, I don't think they do.
Mm.
I know Rick Moranis has come out of retirement for Spaceballs 2.
Oof, yeah, and Mel Brooks is not as funny as he used to be.
I mean, he's 90-something years old.
Yeah, I love Mel Brooks, though. I mean, he's still funny, but I don't know if his movies are still funny. But then you look at something like Naked Gun, it's reminded us that spoof movies like that can still exist again. Mm-hmm. And Naked Gun was surprisingly great. I really enjoyed it. It was really funny.
That's a good example.
It understood the tone of the original series, you know, right. Like it's, legacy sequels, even Spinal Tap's not, it's getting very mixed reviews.
Yeah.
It's a movie that never needed a sequel. Yes.
Yeah. And you hear about these people involved going, you know, we didn't do it for so long because we were just waiting for the right story. Yeah. And then it's like, and it was this?
Yeah.
This was the one that you were waiting for?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Fucking hell,
that's just a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
To go, we were waiting to make it right.
Yeah.
No, you were sitting on your ass.
Yeah.
And you eventually finished one.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
Anyways. Hey, did you guys see who Tilly Norwood is?
No.
Oh, yes. I saw that.
Graham, Google this.
It's it's fucked up.
T-I-L-Y, and the surname is Norwood. So N-O-W-A-R-D.
N-O-W-A-R-D.
Yeah. This is a fucking dawning of a new era.
Tilly Norwood. What am I looking for here? Is it like a TikTok or something?
Okay. No, maybe I thought maybe it would pop up.
It's coming up with Tilly Howard. It's not coming up with Tilly. It's not telling me
all
anything.
All right. So maybe it's not as public knowledge yet.
Yeah, it's messed up. Yo.
But this could be our first AI actress.
Okay.
So there'll always be one. Or there'll always be a first.
Yeah.
And I think someone's vying to sort of make that a thing.
Right.
So she has already got some interest in terms of representations, and and the roles are perhaps, you know, being lined up. It's crazy because it's like, I remember watching the Al Pacino movie Simone.
Yes.
Ah, I forgot. Yeah, Simone was great.
And going, this is preposterous. This is stupid.
Simulation 1. That's what it was short for, Simulation 1. Yeah, I remember.
And when was that made? That was in the 90s.
That was 2000s. Early 2000s. I'd say like 2005, 2004 maybe, yeah.
And this was, having this AI-generated actress who you could superimpose into your movie. And Al Pacino was the producer or director that put her in the movie, and she became this famous star, and he had to keep her a secret.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, now I think it's so fascinating that we could have these actresses. We've already got them online, you know, showing their robot boobs and making bucket tons of money for like middle-aged men.
Yeah, it's
have you
it's
ever seen that footage?
AR slop.
Have you ever seen the footage of like a dude, you know, seductively touching his body and being like, I am her.
Right.
He's prompting it, and it's copying his movements and putting it on the AI woman. And this woman is making, you know,
sexy
moves and is making thousands and thousands of dollars for him.
Jesus Christ.
Yes.
So we're in a hellscape at the moment.
It's wild. It's wild. And I also just think for the representation of artists,
it's awful.
No, it's a dream for them.
Why?
Because they get to put this their person in an infinite amount of projects. Obviously they got to curate and perhaps be careful, but this person can do two jobs at the same time, so they don't have to schedule the talent.
Yeah.
They don't have to put up with any hissy fits in the trailer.
Oh, I thought you meant for other artists.
No, like, of course it fucks everyone. I'm very much on the side of this is scary and not cool, but you can imagine how this will work for Hollywood, where it's like, there'll be a whole, like, right now, as we're recording this, I've got a daughter on the way.
Oh, yeah.
She is going to arrive in late Jan, Feb. She is going to enter into a world where she will watch real-looking humans, and some of which will be real people and some of which won't.
And you won't be able to tell the difference.
She won't be able to tell the difference, and she will probably love at least one AI band.
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean? And be and go and watch them on tour.
Oh, my God.
it's fascinating.
Oh, what I hate
horrible timeline we live in.
Right?
Jesus. But in a way, okay, in a way, if interesting, smart people are curating that person, let's just say it's music or whatever, and are prompting it correctly and getting something out of it.
See, you're immediately using these words like prompt and curate.
Yeah.
You don't curate an actor.
No, of course not.
He doesn't want the AI to come after him when the robot revolution happens.
Fuck you, AI. Fuck you. You can come after me.
Skynet's
I'll flick your off switch, bitch.
Skynet's literally taking notes. Graham Hackney.
Fine. Put me on your list. I don't care.
Yeah. But I think like the thing with that is it's just so insulting to the process of finding a character and digging deep and, you know, like...
No, there's in my head, there's no question...
Yeah, of course.
...that the realness will triumph and be the most celebrated.
Yeah.
I think in the future,
yeah,
the people we know are real, we would treasure them.
Yeah.
And I think we would appreciate what's real.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that I think half of the media we consume will be AI personalized for you, fictitious characters you come to love.
I hate that.
No, it's wild. It's like the movie Her.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
And the movie Simone on Now.
Yeah, it is.
It's like
crazy.
It's like that Malcolm in the Middle meme. You know when he like, he's like, the future is now, bitch.
Yeah, no, it's true. But I mean, you've echoed that sentiment like a lot on the show, where you've said like you still think authenticity will triumph, and I agree with you. The thing is,
I don't think an AI bot could ever have put out one battle after another.
No, definitely not. Yeah. I mean,
it's too odd.
but that's the thing though. Like you look at originality versus what AI is. AI scrapes data from online and then it creates something.
It doesn't actually create anything new.
It
literally can't.
So this actress is a combination of other beautiful people's faces, right?
Sure.
And even the company that released it are saying they want her to be the next Scarlett Johansson. But which is interesting because Scarlett Johansson recently sued a AI company for using her likeness. She doesn't want anyone to own any form of her likeness.
Yeah, and I love that because she was the voice of her.
Yes.
She
was, you know, famously brought in to sort of become the voice.
Yeah, because I think
it was originally going to be something.
Well, I think what happened was it was an AI company where the voice option was Scarlett Johansson's option that they stole from. Literally, obviously, they fed everything she had said from movies, interviews into a bot. And
you only need like something like a minute of audio
crazy.
Recreate someone's voice.
But just to it's be nuts. That guy that counter argues, obviously scouring everything else and the whole internet and the world and all that, all the pretty people or whatever is obviously generative and bad.
Yeah.
But the idea of like a clean AI and the idea of like a team of people feeding this thing like original prompts or original material is potentially interesting.
But it begs the question of why.
Yeah, why would you?
Well, because you can't always be that pretty. You can't always be that talented. You can't always hit every note. But if you can be the creative mind that prompts a perfect character,
a perfect performance.
No,
that's the problem, though.
Sure, of course it is.
Perfection is completely unnatural.
Of course it is.
Exactly.
But I'm just saying. But it's what we as humans have always tried to strive for.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's playing into all the evils of it. Yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
And it's not dissimilar from the Instagram model doing all sorts of things to enhance what they look like.
Yes.
For young girls to see on Instagram, but. If we all just knew that they were robots, like, could that maybe help the young girl?
Yeah, I'm just...
Go like, okay, well, she's a robot, so I'll never be like that.
I'm wondering if they're going to get the hands and teeth right. Because AI, you can always tell...
Struggles with teeth,
yeah. Teeth and hands. So, like, there'll be a scene where she has, like, seven fingers and on one hand. Like, she's got seven fingers on one hand, you know?
But maybe it's... And what's scary is that it could be a combination of... The AI will generate a handful of material, and then they can always use CGI to fix
the hands
and make it
the thing
and change it accordingly.
Because
it's kind of motion capture meets
I understand the whole devil's advocate thing you're doing now. Like, you know, you see why studios would want to use it, and maybe directors it would be obviously directors who don't want to do the process and just want to streamline everything, they don't have to go through the hassle of, you know, rehearsals,
yeah,
improvising, you know, an actor challenging them or them mm-hmm. challenging the actor. The problem is that some of the best performances are ones that you can see are being worked out.
Yeah.
You know, do you know what I mean? I think short form content, characters that do certain things, like maybe more social media,
yeah,
is perfect for this.
Yeah.
I don't think a long film is where we will go or end up.
Yeah.
Like, it might be a short TV show.
They'll definitely try it.
But 100% we're going to get far more in the world of music.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
like,
yeah.
I think the future, like, musicians will be like half-half.
So what's the name of that I know you know this band, that there's that psychedelic folk rock band?
Yeah, they're
called like Brothers in the Dust or something.
Yeah,
or some
it's
shit.
Like the Sun something something Sunset.
Yeah,
they were sort of outed in a way as the first Velvet AI Sundowns.
Oh,
or
yeah, it's the Velvet Sundowns. Yeah, it's
they were the
like
first.
That.
They were the first like AI band that like duped the world, right, where everyone was like, "These guys are cool," and all of a sudden it's like, "Nope, they don't exist."
The thing is with that is it's a dead giveaway when you see the band photo.
They were all very smooth but there was one guy that was
like
fucking handsome.
Yeah, and you're like smiling, and the rest like dead serious. John Oliver, they did a thing on it, and one of the photos of the band is they're all enjoying burgers together, and like John Oliver's like, how can you not see that this is AI? They all look like they have never seen a burger before, and they're like, wow, what is this strange thing? And like all the song names have the word dust in it, the sun in it, sunset.
Sure. No, I mean, and that's the thing, is that there is just no question that it will be this polished, you know, turd of a material, but it's not going to stop.
I mean, I know YouTube has at least taken action, like with YouTube slop, AI slop. Is that like people who post this and content creators who use AI slop to earn money through YouTube? You don't get any monetary returns from it now. They're like, you can post it, but we're not going to pay you because you didn't do anything.
Yeah,
like videos that are just like AI voices.
Yeah,
it's
the same with the voices. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's always like the fucking those really awful ones of like cats and like as like business people and cats as chefs
and little babies doing podcasts.
Yeah, like and you just know the only people who repost those are 60 plus.
Yeah,
women who just discovered Facebook for the first time,
and they're just like, they're "This like, is so cute."
And they're the ones who send you pictures on WhatsApp saying, "Have a lovely day," and like awful gifs of like
it's that
know,
like Christmas gift. There's only like so many people.
It's like
in
flashing
the world
text.
That send you that, and it's like a little
have
reindeer.
A wonderful day, and it's got a little cat like you know crying or something. It's like awesome. You know,
oh, funny. All right, I got one more.
Cool,
go for it.
Did you guys see the trailer for The Bride?
Yes.
It looks nuts.
Looks interesting. It looks like the movie that Joker 2 should have been.
Correct.
Right?
100%
oh, Joker 2.
Agree. I feel like the dude in Subway text. 100% agree.
I thought that was a person. Joker. Joker 2. I was like, who the fuck is that?
Remember the movie Joker 2, Perrin?
Awful.
Remember
Jesus.
That one?
Like the, it's
remember
like
that boring courtroom drama where the one guy just had a weird like makeup on?
It's like a play on Bonnie and Clyde.
And he occasionally sang a really like weird song.
Boring musical set piece. Jesus Christ.
And remember when everyone was like, just wait, it's going to be a classic?
Yeah. And remember that it cost $200 million?
I feel like there's the theory, and I feel like it does kind of track, is that Todd Phillips and Phoenix made that sequel just to spite them, where they're like, cool, let's give them a sequel we did not want to do because they want to cash in on this and purposely make it bad. But like the thing is,
but that's such,
we've spoken about
I mean, that's the most elaborate fucking fuck you.
I could imagine.
They could have just said no.
Exactly.
Joaquin
Phoenix
is
in a position where he could do that. 100%. I don't think Todd Phillips is a well-known enough director to make something bad on purpose.
Yeah. Joker is technically his only I mean, I know a lot of people give it shit, but I think it's his only good, like, film. Hangover, nice. Maybe, but, like, it's not my kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. But The Bride.
Yes.
This is Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her and second directorial film? Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She did The Lost Daughter, yeah. Which was...
It's well-performed, Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tricky.
I liked it.
Depressing.
Very
but,
depressing.
But very cool film. Okay, so this is... We're now in the world of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
So we have a kind of a twin flame situation brewing, where we've got Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein being made for Netflix. And probably getting a little bit of a festival cinema love.
Yeah, apparently they are expanding its cinema release.
Which they fucking should, and it really should come to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Guillermo del Toro.
Well, it's a cinematic movie. Yeah. It's not The Summer I Turned Pretty.
Yeah.
So, like, I think we should have watch parties at the bioscope.
Yes.
Fuck those oaks.
Or The Summer I Turned Pretty. Yes, 100%
we did.
Agree.
We did do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Cool. No, I'm talking about Frankenstein now. and so that's November-ish, and now The Bride is going to be a little bit later. It's for South Africa. It's early next year.
Okay.
And this is about the bride of Frankenstein, because quite a lot of Frankenstein has to do the novel, which I'm so glad I read.
Oh, it's you amazing. Finished it?
Yeah, a while ago.
Great book.
It's lovely, and most of it is about Frankenstein's monster. Mm. Everyone thinks the monster's Frankenstein.
It's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
Did you watch Young Frankenstein?
No.
Mel Brooks. It's my favorite Mel Brooks movie.
Yeah, I think it's his best.
And he's like, oh, it's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. Oh, is that like a Jewish joke?
Yeah. Because Mel Brooks, he loves to,
I've just, clucked that. What the fuck was I talking about? So much of the story is him pining for a solution, pining for the monster, pining for someone to
understand
keep him. Or to keep him company.
Yeah,
he's
companionship.
Like, and he's like, if you could just fucking make me another ugly monster anomaly, we could at least be together and I'll leave you the fuck alone.
Mm.
And he's like, no. Yes. So he's like, well, I fucking told you and now I'm going to come after you. It was funny. Mm. So it looks cool, and we've got old Christian Bale.
Yeah, as the monster.
As the monster.
Mm.
Yeah, it just looks fun. It just
Jesse Buckley as the bride.
It looks very. It looks like Frankenstein via Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm. Yeah, that's what they've been saying, which is great.
Which is again what Joker 2 should have been.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's Bonnie just and Clyde. Like it's cuts and it looks colorful. Yeah, and it looks like. Looks fucking cool.
Yeah, yes. It looks really cool.
Where I think Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein is looking very
more gothic.
Traditional, gothic, beautiful
it's very,
set pieces.
Very del Toro. It
very
looks
del
like.
Toro,
well,
which is cool.
Everything he would do.
The Frankenstein film is del Toro's favorite film ever. That's the first film he watched when he was a kid, when he went to the movies. And
wait, which Frankenstein?
The Boris Karloff one from the 30s. Yeah, okay. So... Those monster movies, so the original Dracula, the Wolfman, Invisible Man.
What I've never watched is a Frankenstein where De Niro's Frankenstein's monster.
Oh, that's Kenneth Branagh directed that. Yeah,
what's that like?
I haven't seen it either.
I haven't seen it since I was like a kid.
I think that's a Video Store Presents. Okay.
I think Young Frankenstein is a Video Store Presents.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. So the Kenneth Branagh one, I remember liking it, but I haven't watched it in literally
the world doesn't
over,
remember De Niro's Frankenstein.
It's not considered a classic. Yeah. Young Frankenstein's a classic. I'm glad Graham agrees because I love Blazing Saddles, but I think it's his best movie.
Okay, cool.
It's so funny. Jeez, like,
okay, magic. Should we get into it now?
Yes,
let's do it.
Okay, P-Dog, tell us about Paul Thomas Anderson and what he means to you.
All right, so Paul Thomas Anderson, so if you look at the batch of these self-taught filmmakers that came out, you know, in the 90s, it was always the conversation was Steven Soderbergh, even though he came in the 80s. Tarantino, David O. Russell, who's very problematic, and Paul Thomas Anderson. They are all famously self-taught filmmakers.
Yeah.
So Paul Thomas Anderson he did go to film school for a week, but then dropped out because he didn't like how the lecturer told them, oh, don't make Terminator 2. you shouldn't be making Terminator 2. You should be making something original. And he didn't like that because he was like, but you can't tell people what they shouldn't make.
Yes.
If a guy comes in here and wants to make the next Terminator 2, fucking let him.
Mm,
as long as it's good, as long as he's passionate about it, cool. So with PTA, for me, I think he's the people don't really compare, don't create the rivalry between those four. It's always Tarantino versus Paul Thomas Anderson. Because at around the same time, they were making big films and they were famously friends and they're famously like, it's a friendly competition, right?
Right.
I want to interject. I saw something funny. I don't know whether it's real. I've got a feeling it's a real, you know, a headline as opposed to an Onion headline. And it was Fiona Apple famously quit cocaine after an excruciating night with Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson.
So Paul,
and I could just imagine like 3 a.m. in a nightclub with those two like hyping each other up, talking absolute dog shit, and just being like, I need to quit drugs.
So that story actually, so Fiona Apple dated P.T. Anderson for a little bit, and he did a few music videos for her. He did.
Okay. All right, so that does...
On her first album, he did a music video then, and he did an amazing music video for her around The Master came out. And a great music video. So it seems like they're still on good terms. But yeah, she was apparently in a cinema with them and they were doing coke and she was just like, fuck, these guys are annoying. And like,
no, because in your head, you know, you think you fucking... making the most revelatory points.
But Tarantino and cocaine.
I've never done cocaine, but I've been around people where I'm like, oh my God, dude, you shut the fuck up.
Yeah,
shut
buzzing, the fuck up. You know? So anyway, so like with P.T. Anderson, I've always felt that he was the better filmmaker than Tarantino, just in terms of evolution of style, in terms of evolution of themes. His themes have stayed relatively the same for the longest time, like... The themes that I always note when I see a Paul Thomas Anderson film is dysfunctional family, number one. Across all his filmography, there's a dysfunctional relationship. Even if they aren't blood family, it's always, there's a dysfunctionality for them. And also one theme that is often overlooked, because another theme is he loves his protagonists to be quite broken characters who are trying to, and in my opinion, one of the key themes of Paul Thomas Anderson is reinvent themselves. You see in a lot of his great movies, characters are often reinventing themselves in one way or another.
Yeah.
Even if it isn't directly the protagonist, someone is trying to do that, right?
Okay.
So anyways, so for me, like the evolution of Paul Thomas Anderson, you watch Hard Eight, which is, you know, his debut film about a these like tricksters in like gambling.
I know very little about
It's got Samuel Jackson, Gwyneth Paltrow, John C. O'Reilly, he's the lead. It's a good film. I think it's his weakest. But then you got fucking Boogie Nights, which he made was at like 26-27, which is insane. It's this epic Altman-esque, you know.
It's a real time capsule film. It feels... What was it the turn from? The 80s into the 90s?
It was from the 70s into the 90s.
70s into the 80s.
No, so the very last scene is 1990. Like,
The
main decades is 70s, 80s.
There's a new year. They celebrate the new year.
80s.
80s into 90s.
No, 70s into
80s. 70s into 80s, sorry. Yeah. And it's like you feel the difference in time and you feel the difference that like something else is coming now. This sort of little capsule of moment is going to end.
Yeah, and that's what I like about P.T. Anderson as well, is that he mostly does period films, and every period film he does, it feels like you are there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Boogie Nights, I felt like I was in the heart of the porn industry in the 70s.
Yeah. Where do you think, just to quickly interject, where do you think the start of One Battle After Another starts? Like, where do you think that is? In the 90s?
I know, 2009. Because if you look at the timeline of how old
2009.
Willa is,
okay,
she's 16 in the movie. So it's 2025. My logic ascertains it. 2009
is
when it
sense.
Happens.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So anyway, so with Paul Thomas Anderson, like, so you got Boogie Nights and you got Magnolia, these far-range, multi-character...
Yo, Magnolia was epic.
Magnolia is his first epic, even though it's a very small film in terms of intimacy. Like, it's it's big in character scale. You know what I mean? That should have won Tom Cruise's Oscar. That's like fucking incredible performance. Everyone is so good in that.
Yeah.
Punch Drunk Love, I felt like his evolution in style jumped up. Like Punch Drunk Love was his first really weird film. Like I still think it's his strangest film.
Yeah, it is strange. And it also, it was a smart move of Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
Because
then
everyone was like, wait, hold on. Mm-hmm. He's not Happy Gilmore all the time.
And that's one thing I love
this
about,
is interesting.
That's one thing I love about Paul Thomas Anderson is that, so he's like Tarantino, he's a lover of cinema. But he is a filmmaker that it has, like, he doesn't have guilty pleasures. So, like, it's fun seeing his list of his favorite movies, and he'll put, like, Meet the Parents in there. And he's like, it's a great fucking comedy.
I don't know who it was. It was one of the podcasters who, I think it was Marc Maron, one of them who got to, like, interview him and was like, I think it was maybe Dax Shepard. He was like, you think he's going to be the serious pontificator of a filmmaker?
No, he's a
filmmaker.
Cool dude. He's a cool dude.
He's dopey as fuck. Like, he was, like, happy and chilled.
No, he's super chilled. So, like, I think with PTA also, so when you look at the evolution of his film, so he's also, he's an actor's director, right? Mm. So he is more about the moment with the characters. He's not necessarily about the story in general. He's more about following the characters. And case in point with The Master, right? But like for me, his evolution into who PTA is now was There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
Okay. 1,000,000%.
Okay.
You watch that movie versus Magnolia, it feels like a completely different filmmaker. Mm. Even though there's those thematic elements there and stylistic stuff, his filmmaking was, it became more grounded. You know what I mean? Because if you look at those early Paul Thomas Anderson films, particularly Boogie Nights and Magnolia, there's a specific shooting style that he does. Weapons does it a lot, where he, like, it's a fast track in and then it slows down on the character, you know, and then it whips to the next moment. And
so Weapons is obviously different filmmakers trying to copy that style.
But you look,
but
yeah.
But sorry, I just wanted, at this point where you're talking about themes and you're talking about this kind of filmography he's created, how much of that is the fact that he's the writer?
Yeah, exactly.
You
right.
know, it's probably the biggest chunk of it.
Yeah.
Because you can dictate that. And I think the moment you're talking about filmmakers, the ones that really have had a hold on their career are the ones that are writing and directing their
100%,
movies.
100%, yeah.
Because the writing is the control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the world building and the fact that, you know, we were talking earlier about the crisis of if you've written a film and then you hand it over to a director, you never know what the fuck is going to come
out. Yeah.
But if you are writing and directing, that means that you are writing it on the fly as this thing stands to change.
So, I mean, like famously with Tarantino, he wrote True Romance and Tony Scott took that and directed it. But like, I think Tarantino's only done two screenplays where different directors have taken it on. Famously, Oliver Stone with Natural Born Killers, Tarantino hated what he did with it. He said that the screenplay is completely different to what Oliver Stone took out of it. And I haven't read Tarantino's screenplay. I'd be very interested to see what the differences
were. He's obviously had his vision of where that could go because he sees the vision because he is a director too. Yeah.
But like with my enchantment, it feels like I'm shitting all over Tarantino. I love most of Tarantino's work, but for me, PTA is the more original filmmaker.
Yes.
I feel like Tarantino's often feels like a glorified cover band. You know what I mean?
Sure.
He takes all his favorite elements of his favorite movies and he just puts his voice to it. And he's good at that. I'll give him that.
And he is honest about it.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, he will say he copies other films.
Yeah, because
like,
I mean,
outright,
famously, he learned about movies working in video store.
Yes.
You know? So with PTA, sorry, I'm saying PTA a lot.
I think everybody understands what PTA means by now. So yeah, let's just say that for...
But for me, he became a great filmmaker. He was a fantastic filmmaker already, but he became an all-time great with There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
And Tarantino famously, like he even admitted, when he saw There Will Be Blood, he knew that PTA was in another realm compared to him now.
It's
and
cool.
That's, his reaction was to make Inglourious Basterds. He's like, okay, I got to step up my game now.
It's lovely. I love these healthy competitions in creative worlds, in history. Very famously, this feels a little bit like the Beach Boys and the Beatles.
Rolling Stones and Beatles.
And those kinds of competitions where they heard the other band get a bit more nuanced, and they're like, fuck, we got to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
We need to match that. It's so cool. It feels constructive.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, well, there will be blood. And like I said, no one works with character just like Paul Thomas Anderson. He gets the greatest performances out of actors. Like,
and that is arguably the greatest skill of the director.
Yeah.
Because there's two moments, really. The one is getting it in the can, and then the other thing is sculpting it.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Like those are your two real cornerstones of being a director.
Yeah, but he's also so good at writing.
Because if you never got it out of them, you can't fucking fix it.
Yeah.
So I mean, There Will Be Blood, incredible film. Then he did, I think The Master came next. Yeah, like 5 years later. And for me, The Master, so There Will Be Blood is his best film, but The Master is my favorite of his.
There's also Phantom Thread.
Phantom Thread is incredible. I think it's his most underrated.
Yeah.
A lot of people overlook it because it seems like the most P.T. Anderson, just in terms of setting and not necessarily style. When you watch it, it's very Paul Thomas Anderson, especially post There Will Be Blood. It's got that tactile feel to it. You know what I mean? Like characters feel real. Characters have I was saying to Graham before, like, because you were saying how surprisingly funny one battle after another is. Mm-hmm. But if you look at all of his films, they are often really funny. Boogie Nights is hilarious.
Yeah, no. I see it more as a comedy than
Magnolia, I'd say, might be his most serious film. Mm-hmm. There Will Be Blood has a lot of funny moments. You know, I Drink Your Milkshake is hilarious. And it's also menacing. But yeah, like The Master, the whole cult thing, it's about Scientology. The Phoenix, that's his greatest performance in my opinion. But then, yeah, you jump forward to One Battle After Another and you look at his whole filmography, you would still argue that he still would be considered a niche filmmaker. You know, he's an art house director. He's not as accessible as a Tarantino, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he won't put bums in the seat like Tarantino or, you know.
Yeah.
But you look at what One Battle After Another is, it's the moment it starts, it feels like the most un-PTA film that he's done. And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah. I think is worth mentioning, and once again, we are not giving much away, is that the first half of this movie is action-packed.
Yeah, it's action-packed.
And so if you were to just see the runtime, you'd think you're in for this long, slow, epic movie.
Yeah.
But do not be deceived by it. It flies by.
Yeah, it's 164 minutes, I think.
Yeah. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. Yeah. Which is, for me, as a cinema owner, not a problem, but it's like it changes my rhythm of how I program it because I'm aware of how long it is.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious of when people get home and those kinds of things.
So that's where I feel like it's a return to the pacing of his earlier films. So Magnolia is over 3 hours, but for me at least, it doesn't feel like 3 hours because of the flow that it has.
Yeah.
Even Boogie Nights is nearly three hours.
But literally with One Battle After Another, like as this movie starts, within about 10 seconds, you get this like jab of music,
which just
has you go like, "Hey, fuck face!" It like grabs you by the collar and just goes, "Watch this fucking movie!" Like we're not gonna lull you in. It's like, "Let's fucking go!"
Yeah,
and you just like, "Oh shit!" And so, it's just like it almost for a split second it feels like it's a mistake, but you quickly realize it's not. It's going, "All right, let's fucking go!"
Yeah,
that's one thing. So like for me, it's just so interesting seeing that Paul Thomas Anderson doing an action film. It's almost like a hypothetical. Like, what if Paul Thomas Anderson did an action film? Or what if Scorsese did a horror film? You know? So, like, it's fun to see it actually happen.
Yeah.
And holy shit, he nails it. Because he's been working on this for a long time. Like, the script for... He says it started coming about, like, 20 years ago. And then it only started to get like serious in the past like 10 years. And I know we were joking about how like, you know, legacy sequels where they're like, oh no, we're waiting for the right moment. He was waiting for the right moment to cast Willa. He was still looking for Willa.
Right.
And then she came through in auditions and they were like, this is like, to quote Mulholland Drive, this is the girl. You know what I mean? This is the girl. So
she's really good.
She's incredible.
So quick back of the box, just for those who kind of need to know this. The plot of this movie, it's effectively about a group of revolutionaries who cause a whole bunch of cack and then go to ground.
Yeah, have to go
and one of something that has happened is a relationship between Leonardo DiCaprio and one of the key members of this revolutionary group, where there is a baby that Leonardo DiCaprio is the father of, and the rest of the movie is him raising this girl, knowing that there is this revolutionary past, and how that kind of. Then the second half of the movie is that sort of coming back to haunt him.
Yeah. So she,
as they are now tracked sort of 16 years later to try and get them. So that's the loose plot of the movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So it's what I love about the movie is it has everything. Like, so I haven't written a review in a long time, and this, even though it's not that like I'm not passionate about the movies that are coming out. I've been very passionate about films like Weapons and Sinners and, you know, everything that's come out. But with this, it reminds me why the fuck I love movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's a movie that is designed to be seen in the cinema. You know, it's famously shot on VistaVision, which is like
I was going to get into that. What is that? Is that a film stock?
Yeah, it's like a film stock, hey? It's a specific format that would be shot in the 60s.
Or so is it a camera?
I think it's a camera.
Or is it both?
I think it's both.
To Google.
It's a format of shooting a movie that hasn't been done since like the 60s.
Yeah, so they experimented with it on The Master. So With this division, PTA has said what he loves about it is that you can shoot very big and also very small.
Okay, and then that feels like a camera.
And that's one thing, even though the film, but like it's a specific feel to it, you know what I mean?
Let's get the definition.
Okay, so VistaVision is a higher resolution widescreen variant of 35mm.
There we go.
Film. So normally 35mm is basically square.
Yeah.
It's almost square. So this is obviously like a wider, I guess it's like a rectangular format, basically, so you can shoot much bigger.
And there's a few shots of that in the movie where you can see the scale of what they're doing. Yeah. But one thing that Paul Thomas Anderson is really good at, especially post There Will Be Blood, is that he is a master of close-ups.
Yes.
And this movie has grand scope in action and you know, one battle after another is a great title because that's what it feels like, one battle after another, you know. And there's set pieces and there's so much shit happening. But when he does a close-up, he only ever uses – for me, a close-up should only happen if there's something I need to show you what's happening on this person's face. Like a change in nuance or emotion or whatever. His biggest influence in terms of close-ups was Jonathan Demme, who did amazing close-ups. Silence of the Lambs, you forget how many great close-ups are in that film. Mm. And he only utilizes it when – okay, pay attention to what they're fucking doing.
Yeah.
And one battle after another, we get so many of those great close-ups where, like, especially on the IMAX screen, you're like, holy shit, I can see what Will is feeling right now. Yeah. I can see what she's trying to cover up and what she's
such beautiful eyes that
she's
can
gorgeous.
Sort of feel this emotion where she just feels so young because she is, but sort of so grown up at the same time. It'll be very interesting to see in our post-apocalyptic future what Lily Norwood, what that close-up looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she's not a human.
Yeah.
And something, if you're looking for a little binge watch, is great, is the TV show Lie to Me.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
because it has you realize throughout watching this great, quite generic cop show, its unique flavor is the fact that the guy can pick up these subtle things that you do. And ever since you watch that show, you become more conscious of what humans do instinctively.
Yeah.
When you know they're uncomfortable answering a question, or if you know they're lying, or if you know they're called micro expressions.
Yeah.
That the fucking robots would never be able to do. So, or it would feel odd watching that robot because that robot will struggle to do that.
Yeah. So like one thing that PTA also loves is, especially, like I said, this close-up era of his career, is the close-ups that he always uses, it's always on the most interesting faces. You know what I mean? And the longer he holds on there, the more you analyze this face, and you're like Sean Penn's character has such an interesting face. Like the ticks that he has with his jaw, mm-hmm. you know, he does the teeth lip thing. He does that a lot.
Yeah.
And
he's trying to compose himself.
Mm-hmm. The way he walks, yes. I love. Like his character is perfectly in line with the name of the character, Colonel Lockjaw.
Yes. Yeah.
No. You know, and Mark Kermode made such a good point. He's like, who's Colonel, he's a film critic. He's amazing. He's like, Colonel Lockjaw sounds like the name of a character out of Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And it's so true, you know.
I predict Sean Penn... being nominated, we'll see if he wins, but certainly Best Supporting.
Definitely a nomination.
For him, and I think Best Film, Best Director.
Yeah.
Yeah, so predictions the right writing, now.
You know, this is, I've confidently said it in the Bioscope's messaging. I'm like, do not be surprised
if this
is all over the Oscars.
Yeah, this will be one of those sweep films.
It should. So music in it is important as well.
Mm. And I wanted to get to that. So this is Greenwood.
Yeah, from Radiohead. So he's the... Johnny Greenwood. Yeah. So he's been doing PTA's scores since There Will Be Blood.
What an amazing next act, eh? Like you fucking do Radiohead.
Yeah.
And a little bit like Trent Reznor, you find this next chapter of your life as a especially the bands that were vibes.
Yeah.
The vibe bands that, you know, weren't generic cookie cutter bands. They were like crafting what in many ways was their own genre, like that industrial sound.
Radiohead in particular, yeah.
And then of course Radiohead were always in this kind of weird little vibey thing of their own.
They're my favorite band of all time. Kid A is my all-time favorite album.
I could totally understand that.
Yeah.
I've struggled with Radiohead for a number of reasons, which I'll say for another day. But it's very cool that you can see the extent of the musical genius of these people and how they can translate their understanding of emotion and what music can do with emotion and how you can find the right pairing of people, like the meticulous, dark fucking vibe of Fincher is perfect with Reznor.
Yeah, 100%.
The two are just...
Even Reznor with Luca Guadagnino now is that he's tapped into a new element of Trent Reznor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But like with Greenwood... His scores are so inventive and like...
I want to pull a Perrin and rewatch it now that I actually know it was Greenwood. Because when I was in there weeks ago...
it sound like Burn the Witch from Radiohead. Like,
I didn't even know it was Greenwood until afterwards. And I, you know, everybody's talking about it now and this is coming up. And I'm like, oh shit.
Because Greenwood. That score is so important to the film. It's almost like the thread that keeps the chaos from breaking. You know what I mean? It's this... Even though it's a chaotic score... most of it is piano driven.
Yeah.
And it feels so delicate that it's almost like the whole film is balancing from a very like this piece of string that's about to snap. You know what I mean? And it's just like holding it there. It's like, I've got it. You know, like I won't let you go. And it's like when you watch Scorsese films, you also forget how musical they are. Goodfellas is essentially one long playlist. Mm, there's almost never a moment in Goodfellas where there's no music playing. Same as Casino, same as like Magnolia as well with PTA is often music playing. And John Bryan's score is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But with this, the best moment, the fucking car chase scene, we're not giving anything away.
Yo.
There's a car chase scene in the third act that is an all-timer.
Mm.
It's in the desert and it's just... fucking incredible. If you go online...
It's like sort of dizzying. It lulls
it's so
you,
different
but it's action-packed, but it kind of makes you sleepy. It's so interesting.
So it's cut to the drum score that Johnny Greenwood has in that sequence, and it's just unbelievable. Like you can see they got the music, and then they cut it to it. They were like, okay.
Just a quick mention is that they are few and far between film scorers, but we have got... an episode in the back catalog with a guy called Andrew Orkin.
Okay.
He's a South African who's gone off. He now lives in the States. And he scores
yes.
for for shows and movies. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's worth mentioning that we try our best at the video store to see how these things get made from the people who make them.
Mm.
Shout out to a future episode. I think it can be next week's episode with Zach Akers, who's a writer. He's one of the guys who wrote him.
Yes.
This Jordan Peele film coming out. So it's cool to hear it from them who live and breathe these things every day.
Yeah.
But it's nice to hear it from people like Perrin who can tactilely feel it.
Yeah.
And appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And we can celebrate these interesting crafts. Because yeah. Also, another shout out to the Denim Richards episode, episode 100, where he raises the great point of just how every single industry in the world is employed by the film industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
And you just forget that the musical genius is involved. And
yeah.
You forget that the, you know, even the Oaks that have to fucking play the tubas.
Yeah.
You know, to get the score.
Yeah. It's like crazy.
Everyone is involved.
Because you also forget how much music dictates pacing as well. So yeah. What I love about the music in the movie as well is it doesn't tell you how to feel. Because a lot of scored music tells you how to feel.
Yeah, I think of the plinky plonky of the Christmas movie. You
yeah,
know?
You know, but
it
like,
just makes you go like, don't worry, this is light. Everything will work out. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom.
But I think it's interesting that the music also kind of like, it almost teaches you how to feel in a way.
100%,
I remember because there's a moment where you hear a particular, like, I can't remember if it's chord or a particular, like, progression on a piano, and you know before you've seen him that Sean Penn's character's there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's a
it's
moment
like a
where
cue,
it's like, oh,
yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you hear him before he arrives musically.
Yeah, so, like, that's, it's interesting because then you look at something like No Country for Old Men that doesn't have any music in the movie, so that's why every plot twist or moment that happens, it's genuinely a surprise because they don't let you in. Yep. You know what I mean? They let the moment take you. But with this, I mean, just everything, it's just such an incredibly balanced film. The pacing is crazy good. Mm-hmm. It's going to win Best Editing at the Oscars. It's going to win Paul Thomas Anderson an Oscar, finally.
Better.
I think for...
Okay, so he's never won.
He's never won, so he should have won for There Will Be Blood, but year was good. It was No Country for Old Men
as well.
That was a
crazy year, dude.
Who won? The Coen Brothers?
Coen Brothers. Yeah. So they won for writing, for adapted screenplay, and...
Directing.
Mm-hmm. And look, I fucking love No Country for Old Men as well.
Sure.
But that should have been the year for PTA because also Scorsese was handing out the directing Oscar that year, and it would have been so nice to have him give Paul Thomas Anderson that Oscar because Scorsese is one of his influences, you know?
Yeah, interesting.
But yeah, I mean, with one battle after another, one thing I loved is that no character was out of character.
Mm.
They didn't do anything we like, wait, that's so out of character. Yeah. Even like early on, we don't want to give things away, but interactions between specific characters from complete opposite ends of the alley or aisle or whatever you want to say, what they do checks out.
Mm.
Especially when you look at it in hindsight, you're like, oh, that actually makes sense. And watching it again, you pick up those moments where you're like, oh, that makes sense why this character is doing this, or that makes sense why this character is attracted to this, or, you know, like, yeah, so...
And it also, just one last little sort of little sprinkle on top is that it's just got a little American... What's the word? Relevance to it.
It's so
just
relevant.
Just a little sprinkle of like, hey, ICE, immigration,
100%.
Nationalism, racism. Just a little sprinkle. Not a jab, just a little fucking sprinkle on top.
But it... That's one thing that's great about it as well.
That gives it a lot of flavor.
Yeah, that's one thing that's great about it as well. Even though, like, every film you watch, it has to eventually pick a side.
Mm.
But with this, it does such a good job in, like, showing the extreme left versus the extreme right, how very similar they actually are.
Totally, yeah.
And how both are bad. You know what I mean? Extreme left, totally. Extreme right. Like, these revolutionaries who use violence to, like, push their message forward, with the extreme right who use their fucking power to push shit forward. I mean, the white supremacists in this movie are terrifying, but they're stupid as shit.
Yes.
They're great. Silly, you know, like they're dumb. And like Sean Penn is just such a great antagonist. And it baffles me because I know when they did the test screenings, people were worried because apparently the studio and the test screenings, so test screenings, they normally do it for normies. They don't normally do it for art people. They do it for, so obviously because it's such a big, expensive studio film, because they've never done test screenings.
You need to get the opinions of the normies.
PTA has never really done test screenings, so they did it. And audiences said that they felt there was no clear bad guy. And what fucking
that's
world?
Interesting.
Sean Penn is very clearly the bad guy in the movie.
Wow.
You know? So, like, I'm interested to see how much that affected recuts. I know they didn't reshoot, but, like, I feel like PTA was like, no, we've got it.
Yeah. Like, that's so interesting. It's like the kind of people who didn't realize that Homelander was a bad guy.
That's fucked up.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. But also, do you know what's crazy? So, CinemaScore is a big factor in America where it essentially determines how well movies are going to do.
Yeah, it's very influential.
So it's essentially a pre-screening where people rate how the movie made them feel.
Yeah.
And basically it gives you a rating from A to F. Okay. So a cinema score often dictates how well a movie's going to do. This movie got an A.
Yeah.
So that shows how much fun audiences had with it. Mm-hmm. I saw someone who made a comment, and it's so true. They said it's the most fun they've had in a movie since Parasite. Mm. And it feels like one of those films where it's going to go over the finish line. It's a prestige picture, which, do you know what a prestige picture is?
No.
So you get Oscar bait, right? And then you get prestige pictures where the studio knows it won't make money.
Yeah.
They aren't banking on it making money. They're banking on it being an auteur's film.
Yes.
And also a film that they would want to push for awards.
Yeah.
It's not Oscar bait, but it's a film where they, like, Killers of the Flower Moon is a prestige picture. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, even though that did well financially, that was a prestige picture. They give it to filmmakers who have such high respect, like Denis Villeneuve, I would say, is a prestige filmmaker. Even though Dune is the first time he's actually made a shit ton of money back, he was making Blade Runner and stuff. Studios were throwing money at him to be like, do whatever the hell you want. We don't care if it doesn't make money. Blade Runner wasn't a successful box office hit, but he still got the money to do Dune, which is nuts to me.
Mm.
You know, and then there's very few prestige filmmakers who make tons of money. Christopher Nolan, Spielberg, Tarantino. It's the guys like Scorsese who don't do it anymore. And I'm hoping One Battle After Another does extremely well. And it's done well.
It had a pretty good weekend, like $50 million.
Yeah, and it far and away was the top movie on the weekend.
Yeah.
And word of mouth is going to push it. It's going to win tons of Oscars.
But that's the thing. Yeah. Even if it doesn't make a ton of money, it's really good for Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Because Warner Brothers have had a very, for the first time in a long time,
they've
had a great year. And now to have something, even if it doesn't do well, with the word of mouth and the inevitable awards that it's going to win, it's very good for
them. I'm loving what they're doing because, like you said in a podcast before, is that the head of Warner Brothers has said next year our tentpole productions, like eight of them, are going to be original films.
Yeah.
Not sequels, not prequels, original works.
Yes.
Even if they're adapted from something, because One Battle After Another is adapted from or inspired by a Thomas Pynchon novel called Vinland, I think.
Yes.
But with PTA, I've noticed when he does adapt something, it's never a direct adaption. It's always inspired by. There Will Be Blood is based on a book called Oil. And it's only really...
It's a starting point.
Yeah.
A launching off point.
He really only adapted the first chapter, and then the rest of the movie is all original.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting.
So it's interesting. I'm just excited for him because even though it's the most accessible PTA film, it's still a fucking incredible film.
Yeah.
No notes. It's just... I think it's a flawless movie. It has everything.
No, that's good.
Like I said, I'm trying not to be biased because he is one of my three favorite all-time filmmakers, but it's hard not to be thrilled by it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? No, and everyone who I've spoken to who don't really know P.T. Anderson or aren't really a fan, they love it. They're like, this is, as the Scorsese meme is, this is cinema, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's sorry. I'm
This is lovely. This is exactly why we wanted you. Yeah. To work this shift today. Yep. So thanks, Perrin. We appreciate it.
You said that he's a surprisingly good action director. Did you see he said he wanted to make a Mission Impossible movie?
I saw that. So he apparently was quite hurt. He was joking, obviously, that Tom Cruise never called him to make Mission Impossible. Because he said he's always wanted to do one.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy watching this movie where you would, because you watch Paul Thomas Anderson's movies post There Will Be Blood, there's very rarely any set pieces. What I mean? And this movie is all about big set pieces, whether it's DiCaprio trying to get his password by getting through a riot that's happening, you know, or like that whole scene is so funny where DiCaprio has to do more comedies again. You're such a great comedic actor. What's your last name? I don't know, man. Batman. You know, but like he channels his best Jeffrey Lebowski in it.
Whenever DiCaprio's got his back against the wall, that's always the best DiCaprio.
Can I add one more thing? Last thing.
Sure.
So if you enjoyed One Battle After Another, I've got four movies you should watch.
Lovely. Let's do it.
So a good double feature would be Ari Aster's new film, Eddington. Mm. I think this is a better version of, well, not version of Eddington. I think it's just what Ari Aster was trying to do with Eddington. I feel like P.T. Anderson did it 20 times better.
Okay.
Eddington is interesting because, like One Battle After Another, it shows the discourse between the right and the left. And it takes place during COVID in a little Western town.
Yeah.
And it's about the panic of...
Yeah.
The pandemic, you know what I mean?
It's more neurotic than this.
It's definitely way more neurotic.
It's like Ari Aster's going, I don't know what the fuck to do about any of this.
Yeah, exactly. I have really enjoyed Eddington. Yeah. There's a great sequence in it where Joaquin Phoenix goes for a full Rambo First Blood and No Country for Old Men. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a crazy action sequence. Anyways, cool. Eddington, great double feature. How to Blow Up a Pipeline by Daniel Goldhaber. That came out 2 years ago, I think.
So I don't know about it.
It does what it says on the tin, how to blow up a pipeline. It's based on a nonfiction novel by a Swedish actor, a Swedish author. And it's just literally about these revolutionaries who decide to blow up an oil pipeline.
Okay. Where is it set?
It's set today and it's set in Texas.
Okay.
And it's about, it's very interesting because it follows each... Like a weapons, it follows certain characters surrounding the moment.
Okay.
So like this part, it's going to follow the guy who's angry about his land being taken up by the oil guy. So it's a cool combination of people coming from all corners of life deciding to get together and be like, fuck these guys, we're going to do something about it.
Okay.
It's fantastic. The synth-driven score is incredible. It came out like 2 years ago. Battle of Algiers, I mean, DiCaprio's watching it in the movie. Yeah. It's a classic, you know. It's by Gillo Pontecorvo. It's from 1966, I think. That film influenced films like Traffic by Soderbergh and French Connection, films like that. And it's done almost like a docu style. It's about the revolution that occurred in Algiers. But it follows particularly like a small-time criminal who joins the revolution to take on the French government.
I did watch it in film school. I feel like every film school in the world watches it, but I should watch it again as an adult.
It's phenomenal. I've got the Criterion. We can do a presents. It's phenomenal. Anyways, Running on Empty. I only found out about this after Paul Thomas Anderson recommended you should watch it after watching this.
Okay.
So it's Sidney Lumet. He did 12 Angry Men.
Love that.
Yeah, great film. And Running on Empty is interesting because it's about... this couple who were revolutionaries during the Vietnam War, they did a bombing where it accidentally like hurt a government worker, and they have a son now. But it's been years after that happened, but they've been living in hiding.
Okay,
and
I can see how it's a similar vibe.
Like One Battle After Another, characters are itching to get back to the revolution. You know what I mean? And this movie, One Battle After Another, is one battle after another. You know, it's just one big action set piece of all these people coming together and trying to reconnect or find themselves, or you know what I mean, right?
Mm.
With this, it shows, it's a more intimate film where it shows the what happens after that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. River Phoenix is in it, and it's about him just like dealing with his parents, like previous life, and him wanting to live a different life. And it's a great recommendation because I love also finding out from directors what they were watching during when they're making this. And I mean, he was watching, like, if you're going to do a great car chase, you've got to watch great car chase movies like Vantage Point or, you know, Duel by Spielberg. You know, like, you got to watch great car chase movies to make something that is maybe a combination or inspired by everything, but also something that helps you make something original. And that's what that car chase is.
Yeah.
It's original. Anyways, I'm done.
Lovely. No, that's cool.
Cool.
One of the last things, also, there's so much to talk about. There's so much meat on this bone.
Yeah.
The generational gap is also fun to play with. Yeah. And there's just, you know, it's really cool to see in one battle after another that the few moments of how he interacts with his daughter, who's now in high school, mm-hmm. and he's like, who is he or she or what?
Yeah.
Or what do I call it? It's like it's not hard, USA. Dad. Yeah. It's not hard, USA. Dad. It's a they them.
Yeah.
It's like,
sorry, I'm just trying to be. I just want to be respectful.
That's great. I want to just mention one thing, which was a lovely. I think it could be a mooch film. It's a particular kind of mooch film. This is a new term that we've come up with, which is like a somewhat easy watching, lazy Sunday afternoon film. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So certainly not what one battle after another is.
Yeah.
Over on Apple TV Plus, I think it's always interesting to see what films they make.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of their bigger films are obviously going out in cinemas and become, you know, these big spectacles from Fly Me to the Moon to Formula One.
Yeah.
But every now and again, they commission these smaller stuff. And what Apple TV Plus makes is very interesting. It's definitely a quality over quantity.
Yeah. I agree.
Where over 100%. On Netflix, it's just fucking
slop everywhere.
Fucking reality TV show bullshit and but true not crime good. Dramas and stuff.
Because you know me, I love reality TV trash, but like there's so much on Netflix, it's just not interesting reality TV.
Where Apple TV Plus is just trying to be a little more curated, a 100%. Little more artistic. So this is a film called All of You. It stars Brett Goldstein, who's an interesting person to watch as well.
Yeah, he's cool.
A very particular character. This is Roy Kent from Ted Lasso, but a very accomplished, very interesting writer in his own right.
Comedian.
And funny in many ways. So
he created one of your favorite shows. Yeah, Shrinking.
Yeah, no, he's great. And this also stars Imogen Poots.
I love Imogen Poots,
which is such a great name. Yeah. I think it is an interesting film for everyone to watch. It's certainly on the artistic side of Normie. So I love her. Obviously, I've chosen to live out my life with Leslie and have a baby together. But she is a Normie in terms of film and,
I love you,
and
honey,
TV.
But
film and TV production well, watching. Yeah. No, but it's lovely to. I think it's lovely to have you guys to do, you know, the real artistic shit with. And I always think it's an interesting litmus test to see what Les enjoys. Like I thought she would love Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and she's like, that's a bit weird. And I'm like,
I love that
movie. It is weird. So you're right, weird. It is weird.
It is
I needed
weird.
To show it to you to realize how weird it was. So she was like, that was a bit arty. But I think it's a great film to watch for anyone who wants to make poignant, interesting character dramas. Anyone who wants to write stories of love and relationships, watch this movie, especially if you're in South Africa, where especially you don't have a lot of budget. So what this movie is it's the story of a relationship where you are literally just getting these vignettes, and they cut quite quickly to each other, so you have to do a little bit of work to go, wait, what's going on, where are we going? What's happening at the hospital
like
that we're going
to? Life kind of.
But you literally just see these moments across their life as you have Brett Goldstein, who clearly loves this woman. They claim to be friends, but it's mostly unrequited love as they move on. And it's got a lovely inspiration of the movie Her, in the sense that it's this kind of very near future. Of course, Her is now set in this year, which is wild. but it's got almost a little bit of a Black Mirror-ness to it, that there's this technology or this idea, world-changing idea that now exists, which is that everyone has a person, a soulmate. The science has been worked out. So like, Graham, you can take the test and we will tell you who the person is you'll love.
Okay.
they might live in the city or they might live in another side of the world, but you at least know it's that person. And so you will love that person.
Mm.
And so she goes and takes this test and finds her person. And she loves them, but she also does love Brett Goldstein's character. And it's the conflict of that. But it's very pretty, very beautiful, very stylish in the way in which her is. And it's got definitely the same kind of vibe and look and feel. And and so, yeah, all of you, it's worth your time.
There's a similar...
And on Apple TV Plus.
So there's a similar film like that. I think it's on Apple TV as well. It's called Fingernails, and it's done by a Greek filmmaker. It's Jesse Buckley, Riz Ahmed, and Jeremy Allen White. And the whole premise is if you are with someone, a life partner, there's a test you take to confirm that they're your life partner.
It's the same. Yeah.
And it's like a blood test and also a chemistry test. And the film, like, if you don't have a life partner, it's a problem. You know what I mean? It's almost like The Lobster.
It's a little bit like The Lobster. Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting because like,
cool.
Yeah,
it's nice to test and unpack and hypothesize about society and humans and human nature and what are we destined for and where are we going to break the mold and you know, it's cool. It's cool to play in that sandbox.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah,
I like little movies like that.
Yeah, it's very much a little movie and it's worth your time.
Cool.
Okay, magic, guys.
Yeah, thanks,
man. We appreciate you.
Mm.
Thanks for the day. Okay, lovely. Our home base is thevideostore.co.za. We're getting more and more folks chiming in on places like the Facebook group, which is exciting. Remember, nice. You can always give us a hey, did you guys see?
Yeah.
Nice.
And that's a lovely place to post what you think is interesting or interesting news that you found.
Yeah.
And then don't forget, you can always give us returns where you just say, I am returning, and you give the name of the movie and you give us your thoughts and opinions. It could be a whole long review or it could just be a few words.
Yeah. Mm.
But we'd love to hear what you are watching and what you are enjoying. All right. Cool. Magic. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.